Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as a tour of the battle space of the war for the free world. We are joined by Christian Whiten, formerly a senior official in the George W. Bush State Department, including in his capacity as a special advisor to the Undersecretary of State for Global Affairs. He is currently the one of the principals at DC International Advisory and a frequent commentator at Fox News and through myriad other outlets where he illuminates some of the challenges that we're facing. And one of them is a breaking story at the moment, Christian Whiten, namely the relationship with Russia and the meeting that President Obama had with his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, today. And I don't know that we've got a whole lot of detail. No open mic, apparently, at the moment, at least. But what's your reading on what came out of that meeting so far? And more generally, you know, what's the status of this so-called reset policy with Russia?
Right. Well, Frank, it struck me as very symptomatic of the overall reset in that it's a lot of symbolism and pageantry, but no real substance. So Putin and the president come out and say, well, we jointly agree that Syria, or that there should be an immediate cessation of violence in Syria. Of course, no pointing to either side as the culprit or the person who's you know, instigating the violence. But there's no specific proposal attached to ending the violence, and certainly nothing. I mean, I have very dim expectations for what can be accomplished at the UN in New York that will help Syria. In fact, I think we have a pretty strong track record that the UN will do nothing. But anyway, the main obstacle, the chief obstacle to the UN doing anything is Russia, and there's no indication at all that Putin is going to change that. I mean, think what you will of Putin, and I don't think terribly highly of him. He is clearly a man who knows his mind, and the notion that, you know, Hillary Clinton is going to redefine Russia's interests for them and have them accept it, or that President Obama is going to go and sweet talk Putin near the gentle breeze of Cabo San Lucas and have him change his mind or his view of his nation's interests seems pretty outlandish to me. And I think we're coming away with this, as we are with the overall reset, that it's led to some beautiful photo ops, but really has done nothing to advance U.S. interests.
The peculiar thing to me, Christian Whiten, and you've spent a lot of time in the senior reaches of the State Department, so I suspect this is something you have insights into, but there has been, despite all that you've said, and I think it's absolutely true, a seemingly unceasing determination on the part of the Obama administration to contract out to the Russians parts of American foreign policy. Again, I guess this is under the rubric of resetting our relationship with them. But am I wrong that they were talking about having the Russians somehow broker a deal with Hafez Assad in Syria, and they've been trying to get the Russians to help them with North Korea, try to get the Russians to help them with the Iranians. And there seems to be very little to show for it, as you say. But what's going on more deeply in terms of thinking that the Russians could be enlisted for such purposes?
Right. Well, I guess there are probably two big things going on. The first is more political, of believing somewhat their own campaign rhetoric that their predecessor, the Bush administration, didn't even try to work through problems with Beijing and with Moscow. And so the thinking that they could come in, just change the tone and achieve a bunch of things that eluded George W. Bush because he was supposedly this arrogant cowboy who didn't care what other people thought. I mean, that was campaign rhetoric, but I think they believed their own rhetoric and really thought that you could change these things. The other factor is this notion in Washington, it's been around certainly throughout the Cold War. I mean, there are probably people who argued this in the 19th century, that you should just give Russia what it wants to an extent, that Russia feels ill at ease because the U.S. and other Western powers are having more influence, more economic play in Russia's near abroad, the term that Moscow uses, we don't. And that has led to the complete, really a near abandonment of our relations with Central Asia. And that matters massively because it has meant that we are completely reliant on Pakistan to access Afghanistan, to supply Afghanistan, eventually to remove our forces from Afghanistan, rather than Central Asian republics, which the previous administration had cultivated very much for that pragmatic reason of accessing Afghanistan and Central Asia, but also because, you know, if you want people, if you want governments in Central Asia to act better, then signaling them that the U.S. will be there long term and have a strong role is important, not just giving in to Russia.
Yeah. When one of the other issues that you've addressed recently, very helpfully, Christian Whiten of D.C. International Advisory and formerly of the State Department, is another area where the U.S. government would, if left to its own devices under at least this president, seemingly defer to others, relegate our sovereignty, I think it's fair to say, to others, is in a treaty known as the Law of the Sea Treaty. Not a prospect that many people in this country, I think, are aware of, but you've given some considerable thought to it. Tell us what's up with this treaty and whether it is advisable for the United States Senate to consent to its ratification.
Right. Well, Frank, as you know, if you don't believe in zombies, then just take a look at the Law of the Sea Treaty and you will believe. this is something that's been around from the 70s. It sort of came together you know, in 1982, I believe, when President Reagan rejected it. I believe his predecessor administration may have signed it, but he refused to send it to the Senate for ratification, declared his opposition to it. You know, there are many objectionable parts. There's some parts of the treaty that are good. They codify existing norms of navigation of the sea. The problem is that already exists, so the question is, why do you need a treaty? Especially, why do you need a treaty that's been around for 30 years to do that, if it's already customary, and if the entity that guarantees freedom of navigation is the U.S. Navy, why would we want to, even on paper, replace that with the U.N.? But it gets scarier because, you know, the U.N.'s not going to do anything that doesn't aggrandize some power to the U.N., and this treaty really doesn't disappoint in that area. Currently, we have sovereignty over our entire continental shelf, so those are our interior waters, our 12-mile territorial waters, our special or exclusive economic zone, and then beyond that, the continental shelf. And that area, especially the continental shelf, is thought to have billions, if not trillions, of dollars worth of oil, gas, and other resources. Currently, royalties on that go to the U.S. Treasury. Under this new treaty, royalties on that would go to a U.N. bureaucracy in, of all places, Kingston, Jamaica. And if you look at the treaty, the explicit reason, the explicit purpose of those funds is redistribution to the third world. Redistribution is very Orwellian language. It's worth looking up Article 82 of the treaty. So it's typical UN, and it's typical of this administration and of John Kerry in the Senate, who's its chief advocate. Although it's an interesting point, Frank, I think, is that, you know, the other advocates are Republicans. Richard Lugar, for example, wants this as a going away present. So you see this androgynous Washington foreign policy establishment colluding against against American interests. So it would be, I think, just a license for corruption and the first tax that the UN could levy directly outside of its member nations, first tax that it can apply to U.S. companies.
Yeah, and Christian Whiten, again, you've spent a lot of time watching this operation, I know, and it's marvelously documented, by the way, in a new film called You and Me by Ami Horowitz that really exposes painfully but quite comedic effect the corruption, as you say, and the malevolence, for that matter, of the UN against this country and other freedom-loving nations, including notably, of course, Israel. One of the things that we're reminded of at this moment, as you say, is the possibility that 70% of the world's surface would become essentially to be governed by a UN agency. There would be taxing authorities afforded. There would be an opportunity to take a stake or take a piece of these considerable resources. But what I really wanted to get at with you on this point is, Christian Whiten, given your experience in diplomatic circles, if the United States commits itself under this treaty as a party to mandatory dispute resolution, under arrangements that almost certainly would be stacked against us very quickly. How do you think that's likely to work out for us and our interests?
Well, not very well. There's a, you know, one of the problems is that anyone can drag us before a tribunal that has no appeal process. So we can be, for instance, a poor island nation can accuse us of causing global warming and climate change and therefore drag us before this appeal, have an anti-American jury, and have a ruling against us, and there's no appeal. So, you know, things like that.
Likely to redound to our benefit, in short. I've got to let you go. Christian Whiten, thank you for joining us. If you'd like the EPA, folks, you're going to love it on steroids under this kind of arrangement. And Christian Whiten, thank you very much for your insights on all of these issues. Come back to us again very soon, if you would, and keep up the good work at DC International Advisory. In the meantime, on FoxNews.com.
I was able to lose the 80 pounds I gained due to pregnancy. It was pretty easy to eat whatever I wanted and not think about it.
The Meta System from Judy Singer has been helping make weight loss easier for a quarter century.
My husband's grandmother used it 20 years ago to lose weight for a wedding and said it was the only way to go.
The Meta System also has an excellent support staff.
They were very supportive. The first time that I ordered the product, they called me and suggested that I order a lower dosage to begin with. They didn't want me to jump the gun right off the bat, and it was nice to know that they actually cared.
And the weight loss is so dramatic, people wonder.
With the Meta System, I've got many questions about how I managed raising a baby and working full-time and lose the weight and eat whatever I wanted.
People who use it recommend it.
I suggested the Meta System to my mother, and she has lost 30 pounds.
Learn more about weight loss with Judy Singer's The Meta System by calling 800-711-JUDY, 800-711-JUDY. The Meta System from Judy Singer, the powerful all-natural way to lose weight, 800-711-JUDY.
The first step in winning a war is to know whom you're fighting. 9 years after 9/11, the U.S. security establishment has failed to tell us. The very words we need to describe the war are being outlawed. We went from the war on terror under Bush to the war on man-made disasters under Obama. Neither identifies the threat doctrine behind the aggression, Islamic Sharia law. That's why the Center for Security Policy assembled Team B, an independent group of national security professionals, including Bill Clinton's Director of Central Intelligence, James Woolsey. The result is a book that challenges the assumptions of the current administration and exposes the supremacist nature of Sharia and the jihad its adherents are obliged to engage in. This report names the names of those responsible and makes plain the mortal peril now posed to America's Constitution, our national security, and way of life. For more information, visit ShariaTheThreat.com or order your copy of Sharia, The Threat to America at Amazon.com.
Congress doesn't have a budget for 2011, but the GOP has proposed a budget for 2012, and Bill Bennett likes it.
Maybe it helps to have that 2012 in the background, people hearing and seeing Ryan and the Republicans saying we're serious about really cutting the budget
as a backdrop
to this debate about 2011. People make the decision, well, Republicans seem much more serious about this.
Bill Bennett's Morning in America. Weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice, intelligent talk.
Listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're joined by Scott Cleland. He is a man of many parts, some of which have direct relevance to what we're interested in talking with him about in this segment. He is currently the president of Precursor, LLC, and chairman of an organization called NetCompetition.org. He was formerly a U.S. Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Information and Communications Policy. He is also the author of Search and Destroy: Why You Can't Trust Google. And Scott, Google is in the news at the moment in what seems to be a relatively white hat role, certainly in contrast to some of the things that you've ferreted out about it. Namely, we're told it is at war with China in what I think it was the Wall Street Journal described as the first war of the digital age. What, first of all, before we get into some of the black hat stuff, what is Google up to in China, and is it in fact a good thing?
Well, Google doesn't like that the Chinese are censoring, and they are among the top five countries in the world that censor and filter and control the internet. And so in this instance, Google is standing up to that censorship, and they have in the past, and the Chinese have, hacked most U.S. companies. They actually hacked into Google a couple of years ago. We learned from the front page of the Washington Post and New York Times that they stole Google's entire password system, and were snooping on Chinese activists. So Google has taken on China and pushed back, and to that I must give them credit. So that's what's going on there.
What does that mean in terms of pushing back? As a practical matter, what is it that a private sector company, even one as prominent in the cyberspace as Google is, what can it do against a sovereign state power that takes very seriously cyber warfare capabilities?
Well, what it's trying to do is to, first of all, it set up its base in Hong Kong, where it could then offer, what it wanted and not go through the normal Chinese filters. And then it's trying to basically alert people in emails and in search results that, there are certain keywords that will trigger a state-sponsored, looking at them or a problem. So they're trying to do some with alerts. But the issue Google has is with, sovereign nations around the world. It certainly crosses swords with countries like China and Russia and others, but it does have a sovereignty problem with many nations. Google has a sense, and now we're talking about the bad side of Google. Google does a ton right and ton good, but it thinks that all the things that it does good give it a license to do wrong, and it believes it's above the law, and it constantly trashes, takes other people's property, it invades people's privacy, it's fraudulent and duplicitous in a lot of its business practices, and so it runs into problems around the world. For example, on privacy, it was investigated by 18 different countries for its WiSpy problems, and it's under antitrust investigation on four continents. So this is not a Google behavior problem that is global and pervasive and something it's been doing for years.
Yeah, this is the subject of Scott Cleland's book, Search and Destroy, Why You Can't Trust Google. And I guess, Scott, just to drill down on again for a moment, we're dealing with a as you say, very much a transnational entity and company. It does seem as though some of what you've described here, at the very least, is alarming, to say the least. With the exposure that you've done on behavior that you call fraudulent, for example, or stealing people's private property, or taking advantage of the information they have that should remain private, and so on. Has there been any course correction on the part of the company? Is there any acknowledgement even that it's done wrong, let alone modified its behavior?
No, it's fascinating. Google is largely in stop us if you can. When they have on the antitrust side, they picked one fight and they're investigated around in four continents. Well, they've picked two more fights. One, and knowingly, when they bought Motorola, they basically have started to use patents in an anti-competitive way. There's a form of patents that are called standards essential, basically the patent for a cell phone or a tablet or whatever. And those are generally licensed as a standard at a set price, a reasonable price. Well, Google is wanting to, renege on that deal and then hold back those standard essential patents so people can't produce a cell phone or a tablet or whatever. That's ridiculous. It's patently anti-competitive, and both the EU and the DOJ are going after them. I wrote today, another area, they're picking another antitrust fight. They are trying to become the world's largest domain registrar. And a company that has 82% share of global search and 92% of global mobile search and 44% of the world's online advertising market, owning a registrar and being the one that gives out domain names, is going to pick another antitrust fight. And then they've also picked fights on privacy over and over again, because the big flap is that they, on Street View Wi-Fi, WiSpy, they were eavesdropping on tens of millions of homes in 33 countries. And then when they were caught, they said, oh, it was a mistake. We didn't mean to do it. Well, the FCC found out in their report, where they said that Google was impeding their investigation. They determined Google lied and that they knew what they were doing. It wasn't a mistake. It was in the design document for 4 years. Multiple people at Google knew, and they accessed the information when they said they didn't. So privacy people are aflutter around the world and really going after Google. And another thing they just did, we knew in the Wall Street Journal had headlines, is that Google hacked into the people's iPhones, tens of millions of people's iPhones, to bypass their security and privacy protections in order to advertise for Google Plus.
Yeah. Scott Cleland, this is a staggering litany of behavior, and I'm only struck by the fact that Google, with the notable exception of your good self and I guess periodically a few others, does not get much bad press. Is that a function of people being frightened of them, or is it because of some control that the company is exercising in one or more of the ways in which you've discussed?
Well, yes, and I think, that's where the duplicity comes in, is that, they have a don't be evil motto. They have billed themselves as the most ethical and moral. They have never admitted to a conflict.
Sounds like the Obama administration, now that you've mentioned it.
Well, there's similarity. They claim that they don't have any conflicts. They're the most conflicted business model ever imagined. And they're adding them all the time. And so they basically, the reason I wrote, Google Search and Destroy, Why You Can't Trust Google Inc. is that they're constantly saying, you can trust us for this reason or that reason. And what I did is I just went and said, does their behavior over a 10-year period in multiple dimensions, in property and privacy and security and conflicts of interest in politics and economics, are they worthy of the trust they claim? And my book has 726 endnotes. I mean, it is, the evidence is overwhelming that they're duplicitous.
Yeah. Scott, let me ask you this in closing. You mentioned the domain name business and trying to sort of assert themselves as, the 800-pound gorilla, I guess, doesn't even begin to do justice to it. There's another effort being made sort of in parallel with this, and I wonder to what extent, having started with the Chinese, we might come back to them. Google is in league with or otherwise engaging the Chinese and the Russians, for that matter, and others who are seeking to exercise more control over the Internet. Give us a sense of that, if you would, quickly.
Yes, the Russians and Chinese are trying to take over the Internet. Basically, they would like, I call it ITUNET, the International Telecommunications Union, or ITU, wants to assert control so that they can tax it, so they can do cybersecurity and other things. But basically, it's a way of knocking the United States down a peg and taking control over communications. It's certainly they're looking for cover in order to kind of create a national net in Russia and in China, where, the Internet is basically filtered. So it's very problematic. And on that, Google's on the right side.
It is. Good. Well, listen, we're going to be monitoring this closely, as I hope you will help us do in the future. Scott Cleland, author of Search and Destroy, Why You Can't Trust Google Inc. Please keep us apprised and keep up the good work. Next up, we will be talking with Congressman Mike Turner about President Obama's new plans for disarming the United States. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hey, parents. Finding it hard to communicate with kids in today's world of ever-changing slang?
Hi, son.
Excuse me?
Introducing the Communicizer. Just strap non-toxic Communicizer to your mouth and go from boring old man speak.
Oh, I'm here if you want to talk.
To 100% off the chain.
Text me whenever, yo.
It's that easy.
Thanks to Communicizer, I'm relevant to my kids again. I mean, I'll fly, boo.
And now when you buy Communicizer, you get the auto-tune attachment free. Sounds so hip-hop, your kids will want to talk to you for hours.
I used to have to walk 3 miles uphill to school every morning, shorty.
I love you, Dad.
I love you too, son.
Communicizer is not available in stores because it doesn't exist. But that's okay. You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. Because kids in foster care don't need perfection. They need you. For more information on how you can adopt, go to AdoptUsKids.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt Us Kids, and the Ad Council.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. In April, Team Obama defied Congress and common sense and gave $1.5 billion to the government of Egypt. No conditions or strings were attached. Worse yet, and in a dramatic departure from normal practice, the full amount was provided in one lump sum. Presumably, the administration meant to provide a vote of confidence in and a cash infusion for the newly elected parliament dominated by the Muslim Brotherhood. Given the Brotherhood's hostility for this country, for our ally Israel, and for Western civilization more generally, this gift was not simply a mistake, it was reckless. Now, with the disbanding of Egypt's parliament and the military imposing a state of emergency, it is far from certain where our money has gone. Who will be held accountable for this hugely expensive mistake? This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at SecureFreedomRadio.com.
Hi, I'm Drew Brees, NFL quarterback for the New Orleans Saints, here with Bugs Bunny to remind you to get moving every day.
Because when you get moving an hour a day,
you fuel your body and your mind.
So what do you like to throw around the football like Drew?
Skateboard.
Play frisbee in the park.
Ride a bike.
Kick the soccer ball around.
Or dance in your room.
Just move it your way.
Because nothing makes you feel better than moving every day.
And that makes you part of a winning team.
So be a player.
You'll have more energy to do the things you like to do.
Move it your way and be a player.
Get up and play an hour a day, Doc. Check out how to be a player at letsmove.gov.
Head online to get tips on great ways to get moving every day.
That's right, at letsmove.gov. Let's hear that one more time, Doc. That's www.letsmove.gov. A message from the Ad Council and HHS.
Okay, I got it.
It's easy to take a day for granted. You and your family are connected by routine, and you stick to it. But what if a disaster strikes without warning? What if life as you know it has completely turned on its head? What if your day's routine is disrupted, and you can't reach your family? Have you planned for that? Before a disaster turns your family's world upside down, it's up to you to be ready. Get a kit, make a plan, be informed today. Learn how at www.ready.gov. Ready.gov. This message brought to you by the Federal Emergency Management Agency and the Ad Council.
You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We're joined once again by one of the members of Congress we admire most, Congressman Mike Turner. He represents the 3rd District of Ohio and is chairman of the Strategic Forces Subcommittee of the important House Armed Services Committee. And Congressman, with the meetings going on between Vladimir Putin and President Obama today, the sorts of things that you've been concerned about and raising an alarm about, really, are very much on the top of our mind. What do we know, if anything, about what President Obama and Vladimir Putin discussed with respect to some of these concerns, specifically about nuclear arms control?
Well, I think there's a number of concerns that we have about the communications with the president and the Russians. As we've seen, both in the New START agreement and in this administration's description on missile defense, they will make concessions without really getting any concessions from the Russians. And our concern is obviously that the president in his open mic incident, signaled a secret deal with the Russians on missile defense, where they might concede our missile defense resources as the merely because the Russians complain or object. The president continues to push for deeper reductions in the United States nuclear weapons, and at a time when Russia and everyone else appears to be increasing their commitment to the nuclear weapons program, to the missile program.
Indeed. You have done a video, actually, on this subject of the flexibility that President Obama has promised Vladimir Putin. Presumably, there was not for our benefit, but for that of Vladimir Putin, more of a pitch along those lines. If only the Russians would give the president until after the election to exhibit that flexibility. What kind of response have you gotten? And by the way, I commend this video highly. I hope people will check out your website, Congressman Turner's website at in the House, to take a look at the evidence that you've compiled that there's something seriously amiss here. What kind of reaction have you gotten to your video?
Well, it's been very positive, and our website address is turner.house.gov, and at that website, of course, we show the House debate on the issue of the president's secret deal with the Russians. But also, we try to give some context that it's not just the issue of the open mic incident. It's, in fact, statements that Vladimir Putin has made where he has indicated he's been receiving offers from this administration that would significantly disable or make inoperable our missile defense system if we were to be attacked by Russia. And I just can't imagine under any circumstances that we'd find compelling an argument from a nation that many times is our adversary, certainly is our adversary as we look at the issue of Syria, and have them say, I want to make it more easy to bomb you, so I don't want your missile defense system to work for our offensive weapons. And the fact that this administration finds that compelling is slightly frightening, and certainly is a grave concern.
Yeah, and it also has to be said that we're seeing, you mentioned Syria, I think it's true of Iran too, though apparently the two presidents remonstrated with the Iranians that they need to be better behaved with respect to their nuclear ambitions. But it certainly is the case that some of the people that we regard as threats, the Russians regard as clients. And for us to be in a situation where we're accommodating these kinds of concerns may redound to the benefit of their clients as well. Congressman Mike Turner, let me ask you about something else. Our colleague Bill Gertz of the Washington Free Beacon has an important piece out today describing a new nuclear posture review. They're calling it the mini NPR. What do we know about what the administration has in mind with respect to our nuclear forces, at least if this reporting has any guide?
Well, these are our major concern. Usually any posture review that's done where the military undertakes a study from which they scope our forces, both in size and in purpose, is based upon an assessment of the threat of this administration from the initial speech that the president gave in Prague saying that they wanted a world with nuclear weapons has merely gone to reduce our nuclear weapons. And we're very concerned that this posture review that the administration is going to put out is going to argue for reduced nuclear weapons, reduced, obviously, resources for the United States at a time when we only see the threat growing.
And how deep are the cuts that they seem to have in mind, as best you can tell? I very much take your point that this seems to be ideologically driven, not a function of the threat, which is a problem in its own right. But how deep are these ideologues proposing to cut into our nuclear capabilities?
We don't have the actual numbers yet, but the real issue that everyone is concerned about is that the cuts appear to be, the earlier reports appear to be, to the levels that they would threaten our nuclear triad, our ability to keep weapons in all three of the legs of the stool that keep us safe. The whole concept of deterrence is that it deters the other side from either using nuclear weapons in a conflict or even initiating a first strike. When you go down to a level where it makes possible that someone could win that gamble, that they could, by striking you, disable or make it incredibly unlikely that you would be able to have a normal response.
An effective retaliation.
They might be tempted.
Yeah. And I guess what we're hearing from Bill Gertz is that the numbers may be as low as 1,000 nuclear weapons. That may seem like a lot to the layperson, but it is a dramatic decline, even from what the administration signed up to just 2 years ago with the new START treaty with the Russians. It may or may not, I guess, depending on what some of the details are, which I guess you'll be hearing about Congressman Mike Turner and the House Armed Services Committee shortly as this mini NPR is unveiled, may have some other features to it that have been promoted by one of the previous commanders of Strategic Forces Command, General James Cartwright, namely de-alerting some of those forces, if not all of those forces that are still operationally deployed, and then simply getting rid of many of those that are no longer deployed that are nonetheless being held in the inventory. Are you hearing anything along those lines? And if so, what are your thoughts on the advisability of doing such things?
We have not heard specifically, but we certainly have heard things that concern us, that those might be the types of issues the administration looks at. And again, all of these things go to the issue of weakening our national security. None of them are accomplished with an ability to at all persuade or dissuade anyone else from taking action that would either threaten our national security or dissuade them from pursuing weapons that make the world less safe.
Yeah. Well, I'm fond of saying that the president is all about ridding the world of nuclear weapons, starting with ours. This is the way to go about doing that, I guess.
Especially since we're the ones that keep everyone safe. I mean,
yeah.
Between Russia and the United States with respect to Syria, you know, we're on the side of liberty, we're on the side of freedom. When you take out our nuclear position, you make the world less safe for those who certainly
are the freedom-loving people. And as you know so well, Congressman Turner, you may well see some of those countries who will feel less safe opting for their own nuclear deterrent capabilities in the event ours is no longer, providing us what's been called the nuclear umbrella to them. Let me ask in that regard, Congressman, one other issue that's sort of implicit in all of this but needs to be said. The administration seems to be pursuing all of these nuclear arms control initiatives, if in any negotiated way at all, in a bilateral way with the Russians. The Chinese are also quite formidable nuclear powers. In fact, as best I can tell, we don't have a clue how many nuclear weapons they may have, as they've now concealed many of them in these the so-called underground Great Wall of tunnels. Quickly, sir, what's your thought on how the Chinese ought to fit into all of this, and especially as we get down to these very low numbers?
Exactly. If the president negotiates a deal with the Russians, he's making a mistake of thinking that it's still just a two-polar world, both with China, what we're seeing with North Korea, Iran, what we're seeing with, of course, Pakistan, India. There are formidable nuclear powers out there that should be taken into the calculus, should be taken into the issue of, how do you scope and size the United States nuclear stockpile?
Right. Congressman Mike Turner, we have to let it go at that. I appreciate very much you being with us and your leadership on these issues. Check out the video at Congressman Turner's website, and please also support him in the important work he's doing to ensure that the ultimate guarantor of our security, our nuclear deterrent, remains safe, reliable, and effective. Congressman, we look forward to talking with you again, maybe after the NPR formally is unveiled and we can get your sense of what needs to be done now to remedy the situation. Next up, we'll be talking with Andy McCarthy, getting into the Muslim Brotherhood in Syria and here, straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
I went from a size 18 down to a size 5, and I was able to keep it off.
Angie had some serious challenges.
I had gone through a divorce and put on quite a bit of weight. There was an accident where I was put on a lot of medications, and I put on over 60 pounds. I tried every kind of diet, but diets just did not work.
Diets don't work is something they hear a lot over at the MetaSystem from Judy Singer.
I heard about Judy Singer's MetaSystem, and I thought, well, couldn't hurt to call, and I called them up, and they told me all about the product, and I thought, well, I'll give it a try. From the first week that I was on it, I wasn't hungry a lot, and it was just amazing. Jumping about 3 months ahead, I dropped 63 pounds.
If you're ready for a natural product that cleanses your system system and helps you lose fat, talk to a Judy Singer counselor about the Meta System. Call 1-800-711-JUDY. 1-800-711-JUDY. The Meta System from Judy Singer. Powerful, all-natural weight loss. 1-800-711-JUDY.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
I have held the same mirror for 13 years.
I have been decorated with purple dinosaurs, baseball teams, and football helmets.
I have witnessed 33 Thanksgiving dinners and one wedding proposal.
I have tiny notches marking the growth of three children.
I have caused a learning disability.
I am the reason that a fifth grader simply can't sit still.
I am responsible for a five-year-old's rage.
Just because you can't see lead paint doesn't mean it's not on walls, doors, windows, and sills. Today, lead paint poisoning affects over 1 million children. If your home was built before 1978, your family could be at risk. Let's make all kids lead-free kids. Log on to leadfreekids.org or call 800-424-LEAD.
I am the reason a child has trouble hearing.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
Brought to you by the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD, and the Ad Council.
Is Nancy Pelosi looking to a higher power to get a balanced budget? Hugh Hewitt sets her straight.
When I hear you speak about this issue, of course, it's the Gospel of Matthew. When I was hungry, you gave me to eat and listen.
I just got to stop here. Nancy Pelosi quoting the Gospel of Matthew, as though that's got anything to do with the government. Let me just tell you, it doesn't.
Can I get an amen?
The Hugh Hewitt Show, weeknights from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice, intelligent talk.
If you're a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, like me, coming home can be harder than expected. I felt a little out of place, but it turns out I wasn't alone.
At IAVA.org, there's a free online community of thousands of OIF and OEF vets who've got your back here, just like they did over there.
So now, I'm never alone. I can get the resources I need, and talk to tons of people who understand where I'm coming from.
Whether it's navigating the GI Bill,
or VA hospitals,
managing the transition home, or meeting people you can share stories with,
you'll find it at IAVA.org.
Even if it's just everyday stuff,
like getting tips on where to find a nice sweater for my dog.
Did he just say that?
Really? What?
Okay, maybe not that, but everything else. No matter where you are, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org.
We've got your back.
Brought to you by Iraq Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom, it's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're joined by Andy McCarthy for what I consider the high point of our week, our visit with him on piece of the battle space of the war for the free world that I guess is best described as lawfare, but it broadens nicely from that as a result of Andy's writings and musings and commentary on a host of related issues. And I'd like to get into three in particular with you today, Andy. One involves a running debate that you have now been contributing to brilliantly, characteristically, at National View Online, principally, with fellow conservatives about Syria, and specifically whether we should intervene there. Our friend and colleague, the Foundation for Defense of Democracy, Cliff May, has been one of your sparring partners in this. Give us a sense of what the argument is about and how it's going.
Well, I think that I've had this debate back and forth, Frank, not only with Cliff, but with another friend of mine at the Foundation for Defense of Democracy's Michael Ledeen. And I think, you know, we do have some common ground, which is, I think, the same common ground that you and I share and that we all share, which is that we would like to see democracy promoted in the world, but we want to make sure that it's authentic democracy, and we want to make sure that the way that we're promoting it is something that actually catalyzes authentic democracy rather than being a smokescreen to do things like arm and train people who, far from being Democrats, are actually jihadists and Islamists.
And enemies of ours, by definition.
Yeah,
as well.
And pronounced enemies of ours, absolutely. So I think that, you know, look, it's very difficult for people to look at what's going on in Syria and sit on their hands, even if sitting on their hands is actually the best thing for American interests, because, you know, when I think, as I point out in the article to which you refer, America has a kind of a lightning rod effect on our enemies. They actually despise each other, but they abhor us more. And when we get involved, they put aside their fractiousness to unite against us. When we're not involved, they beat each other's brains in. And since in the Syrian equation, we have Syria, Iran, and Hezbollah lined up on one side, and the Muslim Brotherhood, Al-Qaeda, and various other Salafist/Sunni militant organizations, and it's in our interest to see all of those organizations weakened. The last thing we should want to do is make one of them stronger, one side stronger than it currently is, just because somebody feels like we have to do something. And I also worry that we're kind of stuck in the mindset of 2001, 2002, when I would agree and said many times, I think we both said, that Iran was a singular threat to the United States. The fact of the matter is that threat environments are not static, they evolve, and the Muslim Brotherhood threat in many ways is just as threatening as the threat posed by Iran and the Shiite supremacists. So I think we have to make different calculations when it gets to American involvement.
Yeah. And Andy, in your most recent piece at National Review Online, you, I think, made two particularly salient points. One is, how much would we have paid to fracture the relationship between Iran and Hamas, which has now been done as a result of this thrashing around in Syria? And the other is the point you just alluded to, and that is that we have, in fact, in the Muslim Brotherhood, a threat to this country that is unfortunately not simply manifesting itself, as you know so well, having written about this in the Grand Jihad and to some extent in Willful Blindness elsewhere, notably in the arc that is developing in the Middle East under their control, more or less, Egypt being in play, I guess, again at the moment, but also here in the United States as well. And I think you've held your own marvelously in this conversation, and I really welcome your continuing inputs and those of Cliff and others who I respect as well in helping us understand what's going on there in Syria and whether we do in fact have a stake in getting embroiled in it. Andy, let me turn to another controversy that you are also in the middle of, contributing, I think, also very helpfully to, and that is a debate between some conservatives now over, is there a problem with Sharia or not? This totalitarian doctrine, as you know so well, that the Muslim Brotherhood and others are trying to impose worldwide.
Yeah, well, I don't know how conservative some of the conservatives on the other side are. There was a salvo that was posted in National Review several days ago by a guy named Matthew Schmidt, who I think is the deputy editor of First Things, which is over the years has been a very solid publication. I'm not talking about, you know, conservative or liberal, even though I think it was mainly conservative leaning, but it certainly has very deep, thoughtful pieces, particularly with respect to theology and the issues that ramify from there. I think what's happening is that there is a concern, and I'm going to try to give them more due, or give Mr. Schmitz more due than he gave to those of us who were concerned about Sharia encroachments, who he simplistically called anti-Muslim bigots, which is the kind of thing that doesn't really have a place in the kind of discourse I'm used to seeing at National Review, which was why I was disappointed that they ran the piece. But I think to look at people who I admire on that side of the argument, like Robbie George of Princeton, I think that there's a great concern about religious liberty in the United States and what can be a consequence of cracking down on, as they put it in a very, I think, simplistic way, Islam, and whether the arguments that are addressed to that end can then be used against other believers by secularists and activist atheists in the United States. And I think that's not a frivolous concern, but what they're missing is that there isn't just one Islam, and the Islam that we're talking about, and I know that, you know, they'll be screaming that I'm an anti-Muslim bigot again for saying this, but it's simply a fact. The Islam we're talking about is not principally a religion. It's an ideology that has some spiritual aspects, and it features an authoritarian legal code and really model for society that has a lot more in common with, say, Soviet ideology in terms of its approach to society than it does with a religious doctrine like, Judeo-Christian theology.
Yeah, I like this turn of phrase, communism with a god, to describe Sharia. Yeah.
Yes, exactly right. I think that comes from Bernard Lewis, at least he quoted it.
I don't know, but I'm citing it shamelessly without knowing who is the original author.
Yeah,
but
I think
it
actually Lewis cited it in the 1950s, and he was more right then than he is today.
Yeah, sadly, Andy. I guess the bottom line on that particular topic is that we are seeing people who are not necessarily all that conservative, but nonetheless thoughtful people coming down in a most unhelpful way. And I appreciate your efforts and those of David Yerushalmi and others to Andrew Bostom to challenge what's going on here. It is the height of folly, it seems to me, to be ignoring this.
I have to say, Frank, Andy Bostom made the point in a piece that he published today, I think, at PJ Media. It's a conversation that we have to have on the right.
We do. And in the country as a whole. Andy, finally, very quickly, you've also commented on another controversy, the Obama versus the rule of law controversy. Quickly, what's up with that, and what do you make of it?
Well, there's always something going on with Obama and the rule of law, isn't there? I mean, this is an administration that has run roughshod over the rule of law while using it as a jingo from the first day. But what I think has happened is the most profound assault on the Constitution, not just by this administration, I think in the history of the American presidency, which is the context of it, is Obama's announcement that he's not going to enforce the immigration laws against the category of young people who have come to the United States, he says, through no fault of their own. You know, they found themselves here because their parents were illegal aliens. Of course, that's not our fault. It's their parents' fault. But, leaving that aside, the fact that he's doing it in the context of immigration is important. But the more important fact is that he is assuming to himself or arrogating to himself the right to pronounce positive law, which under our Constitution only the Congress can do. So he is ruling progressively day by day more like a dictator and less like a president. He has become exactly what the framers were concerned about when they tried to limit the presidency so that it would not become a sovereign or a king.
He must not be allowed to get away with it. Andy McCarthy, thank you for holding him accountable and for helping all of us understand the stakes on this and all of the other issues we've discussed and so many more. Come back to us again soon, if you will, and I hope the rest of you will do so as well. Tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
Listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.